Okay, thanks, Gina. She left out my career as an auto worker. Okay, so this is shows you geometry of microlensing. I'm going to begin with the tutorial. So you got an observer and a distant source over here, and then in between there's some massive object. The source is bent, the light from the source is bent by the lens, goes to the observer. The observer in principle can see two images, but in microlensing these images are separated by less than a milliarcsecond. So you don't see any two images, but because the system's convex, the images are bigger than the source, so brighter because the surface brightness is conserved. And as the source gets closer to the projected position of the lens, it gets brighter, and then it gets fainter, and you get a microlensing event. Okay? So this idea, Einstein realized that there would be this microlensing in 1912. He didn't write up the idea for 25 years until he was stalked by a Czech engineer. Eventually he did write it up, but the reason he didn't write it up was because he thought that these would never be observed. Now, of course, in 1912, general relativity hadn't been invented yet, so he was off in his cross-section by a factor of two, but that wasn't the main problem. Just as sources and lenses have to be so closely lined up, he believed none would ever be discovered. But today, 100 years later, there's been close to 20,000 discovered, and they've gone from being unobservable to the most important aspect of astronomy today. Okay, so that's the end of my tutorial. Everything else that you want to know about microlensing can be easily solved if you can just solve a 10th order polynomial. Okay, so now we're going to move on to planets. Okay, there's 1991, Schutemau and Bode-Paczynski realized that these microlensing surveys that were getting underway to find dark matter could turn up binary stars and also planets. Okay, so if you have two stars causing these bumps instead of one, you think you're going to get two bumps, but actually it causes astigmatism in the lens. And so those astigmatisms are characterized by caustics. These are curves of infinite magnification. And when the source goes over one of these caustics, if it was infinitely small, then it becomes infinitely magnified. But because it's finite, it gets smeared out, and you get these light curves. If you have a binary star, then the caustics are pretty big. But if you have a planet, you still have a binary of sorts. You get small caustics. If your trajectory kind of misses these caustics completely, then you just end up with an ordinary microlensing event. But if it gets close to or over them, then you get these little spikes and you can find planets. So the next year, Avi Loeb and I pointed out many things, but one of them was that these events would typically actually produce two bumps and not a big bump for the star and a little bump for the planet. So the ones shown by Mao and Paczynski are sort of atypical. And we also advocated that survey and follow-up teams combine, because it takes a survey team to find huge number of microlensing events, because they're just tiling the sky, kind of going like this all night, and then follow-up groups can repeatedly observe those events that are already found, and that's needed, because if you're tiling the sky once per night, and these events are typically lasting 30 days, and the planet is the square root of the mass ratio and duration, so it's one day. So if you're looking at it once a day and you get one point, you don't figure out anything. So we advocated forming survey and follow-up groups, and we sort of showed that the typical scale here was of order several AU, which meant it's good for finding planets, which is just a lucky coincidence. And we also characterized what it was you could learn from these light curves. Okay, so the light curves have two bumps. So each bump is characterized by three parameters, a height, a width, and time it's happening. And so you have six parameters. Or six characteristics of the light curve, and then there's six microlensing parameters that you can use to just write down the equation of what one of these light curves is going to look like. Now, a very sad fact is that the only one of these six parameters that really has much to do with the planet is the mass ratio. And the mass ratio, when you find mass ratio in some, alpha sand or something like that, then you actually also know the mass of the planet. But in the case of microlensing, you can't see the star, so you don't necessarily know the mass of the planet. And then you find the separation in units of the Einstein ring, but anyway, you don't know how big the Einstein ring is. So it's a basically statistical method. And these, these characteristics are just shown here. You've got three characteristics of this bump and three characteristics of this bump. A couple of years later, Scott Gowding and I realized that there's actually another parameter, the normalized source size, because these sources are passing over these caustics, and then the bigger the source is, the longer, the more smeared out the caustic crossing is. So in the case of this event, again, you have this extra thing here, it's actually what's shown here. It's a slow dip. This is caused because this is all the time that the source is crossing the caustic. So the bigger the source is, the longer this takes, which is shown up here. At the beginning, this just looked like a nuisance parameter, but we'll see it's very important. Okay, so this is a situation a couple of years ago for microlensing. It hasn't qualitatively changed. There's a gazillion Kepler planets over here. You know, there's like 1,000 radio velocity planets. At this time, there's sort of 10 microlensing planets now. There's like, you know, 30 published and, you know, maybe 20 more coming. So it's, you know, unequal battle between us and Kepler. But the one thing that we have going for us is that we're finding these planets way out here where other people aren't finding them. So it's an interesting region of parameter space out beyond the snow line. Now, if you plot this plot on a semi-major axis in AU, it doesn't look so dramatic because other methods of finding planets are photon starved. So they're always looking for bright stars, and so typically G stars, and then we'll do some other ones. But in microlensing, you know, we don't see the star. So we don't care how bright it is. And so we're more sensitive to low mass stars, and hence the same number of AU is further out past the snow line. This is microlensing's bailiwick. Just another view of how microlensing detects planets. You have source going by here, going by the lens. The source goes into two images, one of which wraps around the Einstein ring this way, one of which wraps around it this way. If the image goes beyond a planet, this is a planet of the lens, then it causes a spike. If there's a planet the same distance from the host star, but not by one of these images, then it doesn't cause anything, and so you don't see anything, so statistical. This is one of the first microlensing planets found. Looks just like what Avi and I said it would look like. It has an extra little bump here. This is a Neptune mass ratio planet. Probably the host is an M star, but we still don't really know that for a fact. This is another one of these very early events found. This is more like the Malin-Pachinsky events. It has some complicated structure at the peak. So there's no two peaks, one for the star and one for the planet. At the beginning, you know, it was hard for us to figure out what to do about these, but now there's a bunch of people who can do Volkmann mind melds with these curves and instantly figure out what they're showing. So the main focus of this talk is going to be on parallaxes, on microlens parallaxes. And this is driven by something that I figured out in 1992. So I told you we don't know the mass, and we also don't know the distance of the lens. And so that's a, you know, it means that we could study some statistical ensemble of these events to figure out about planets, but we can't really find out about individual planets. And even our statistics, something like finding a break at 10 Earth masses or something like that, which for Neptunes, maybe people think there's such a break. It's very hard to do that in RV because it's smeared out by, you know, M sin I. It's very hard to do that in microlensing because you don't know the masses of your stars. And so the idea would be to find masses and distances of the host and therefore the planet. So I noticed that there are two observables. One is the angular Einstein radius. So this is the size of the Einstein ring projected on the sky. If you could see the two images, then you would know the separation of the images, of course, and that's equal to an Einstein diameter, so it'd be very simple. You can't actually see the two images, so, but anyway, in principle, I'll show you this is observable. And the other thing that's in principle observable is the projected Einstein radius. So if I went over here and looked at the event, I would be just at the edge of the Einstein ring. I'd see a mildly magnified event. At this point, I would see, you know, a highly magnified event. And so if I had a satellite over here, or some other observer here, and one over here, then I'd know how far away they were, and I would know how, you know, big this projected Einstein ring is. So, I mean, you can just intuit that if you have these two parameters, you can completely solve the triangle. But in particular, you know, this angle is to this distance, is this angle is to this distance. Well, this angle is the Einstein bending angle, is the one that Einstein got wrong by a factor of two originally. And if we just take that equation, cross-multiply the terms, we find out that the product of these two observables is equal to the mass. And the ratio of them is equal to the relative parallax, so basically the distance. So if we could just measure these two parameters, then we would get everything that we want to know about the microlensing event. So I was super happy when I figured this out, and I began a 20-year quest to be able to systematically measure these. But within a couple of years, I realized that each one of these two parameters, using anything like the techniques that people were had available, that each one of them, there's a 1 in 100 chance of measuring it, and they're more or less independent. So you have a 1 in 10,000 chance of getting a mass and a distance. And this turns out to be more or less right. So we have tens of thousands of events now. We have a few of these coming forward. So that was very depressing. But anyway, I decided to try to figure out how to make that work. OK, so one part of it actually is pretty easy, both easy and difficult. I told you before, there's this finite source, you know, smearing out. So you can figure out how big the source is compared to the Einstein ring, you know, just as a parameter in the light curve. But then you can figure out how big the source actually is because you can measure its color and magnitude. Then you could, you know, compare that to some standard candle like the clump, and then you can figure out how big the source is in microarc seconds, and then figure out how big the Einstein ring is in milliarc seconds. The trouble is that in the point lens events, this is happening very infrequently because the sources are microarc seconds and the Einstein rings are milliarc seconds, so it's sort of 1 in 1,000, 1 in a few hundred chance that this is actually going to happen. That's why I'm so depressed about it. But for all planetary events, or not all, but a large fraction of them, the way we know that they're happening is that the source passes over a caustic. So there's these other structures, and of course it might not pass over the caustic, but then you know there's a planet anyway. So if you find a planet, then you already get this effect, and you can figure out the angular size of the Einstein ring. That's one of those two parameters. So you're, you know, up by a factor of 100 compared to the previous depressing situation. So it's just the equations associated with that. The other part of this, though, is the microlens parallax. So this requires a little bit of, this is the hardest math I'm going to show you. So just consider that you have two stars, which are not yet a source and a lens, but anyway, one's further away than the other, so you can see that's the one that's further is red. And they're both wiggling back and forth due to parallax, and they're both moving like this because of proper motion, or they're moving similar directions in this case. So now let's go up here and consider relative parallax and relative proper motion. Okay, people don't even know what this is anymore because we have Aparcos, now we have Gaia, and they do absolute parallaxes, and people can forget about that. But for people who were educated in the last century, like Professor Marcy knows what this is. So just put the source over here, and then you know, the lens then is moving back and forth because it's closer, okay? And it's also moving like this. So this green line is what you would see if you were at the sun. Okay, so that's all. There's nothing to do with it being source and lens. But now what I've done is I've drawn around it an Einstein ring. So now you're finding out how far apart these things are in the Einstein ring, and that's telling you how magnified they are. And so seen from the Earth, you get these dramatic wiggles, and seen from the sun, which we don't have any observatories at the sun yet, but anyway, if you did, you see a normal microlensing event. So why is it a normal microlensing event if only visible from the sun? The reason is we don't have microlensing events lasting many years like this. They go by in like 20 days. So it's more like a situation like this. So then the event looks different from the Earth and the sun, but they both look basically like these normal microlensing events. And that's what makes this parallax so tough. If we could just put an observatory on the sun, we'd be sitting pretty because we just see two different microlensing events. So you know, the one from the Earth would be slightly distorted, but we wouldn't care. Okay, so that. So the distortions in the Earth have been seen. So this is my 1992 paper, you know, with this idea. Here's the first one of these observed. Out of tens of thousands of events, we found a few that are actually wiggling over the course of several years, but it's very, very rare. So I need to mention now that microlensing parallaxes, unlike trigonometric parallaxes, which are scalars, microlensing parallaxes are vectors. And the reason for the difference is that in a trig parallax, you can actually see the source and the lens, so you know which direction they're moving. But in microlensing, you can see the source, of course, but you can't see the lens, so you don't know the direction of the relative proper motion, and that's one of the. So you get an amplitude of the parallax, which is the size of the source-lens relative parallax scaled to the Einstein ring, but you also have to have a direction, and that's the direction of proper motion. So it turns out, we'll see, that these one-dimensional parallaxes are extremely common. They're so common, people don't even note them usually. I had to go through the literature and find there's like half a dozen that have ever been shown. Because whenever you have a one-dimensional parallax, you basically have zero information. You don't even bother to report it. So for example, this one here is reported solely because it was one of the first ones to be noticed after, you know, the possibility was pointed out. Here's another one that was actually useful for something. Here's one that's useful. What is the reason for this? If the source and the lens are moving parallel to the direction of the Earth's acceleration, if the relative motion is parallel, then the rise of this curve is going to be faster than the fall, and you're going to get a deviation, an asymmetry. Since microlensing events are intrinsically symmetric, you find an asymmetry, okay, you know, through this. So that direction is easy to measure, but if you have it going perpendicular, then you have a symmetric distortion, which still doesn't look exactly like this light curve, but because the events are intrinsically symmetric, there's a lot of symmetric parameters that go into that that can absorb everything, and so you get no information in that direction. So what can you do? Okay, so the first thing you could do is you could just look at nearby lenses. So nearby lenses have larger parallaxes, so they're you know, going to have, you know, be easier to measure, and also you could look for low mass lenses. Of course, you don't know how to look for these things. You have microlensing events, and you're stuck with whatever you get. But anyway, if you find you're measuring parallaxes, probably they're nearby. And so this is just showing that those you're really stuck with long timescale events. So this is just a bunch of math saying that this is showing up. These effects are showing up only at fourth order, and so you get long events. And this is proven in practice. So here's an eye chart with a bunch of events that were taken out of you know, paper doing planets. The main thing to say is that of the things that say GM, blah, 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 those are the ones that have microlens parallax measurements. And all of them are pretty long. It's just M equals theta. Okay, all of them are pretty long, like 100 days, 121 days, 117 days. You know, the shortest one here is 68 days, except for the one that's 7 days. Well, those four, they're all much longer than ordinary microlensing events, and the seven-day one is the exception that proves the rule, which I'll get to in a second. So here's one of those events, a spectacular event in which the parallax was measured, and actually, this is one of the rare cases where the lens star was actually seen, so we predicted what the mass and distance of this lens were, then we said how bright they should be, what color they should be, you go out and look at a telescope, you actually see it. So it works in these rare cases. There's another really great event, which has a binary star and an Earth mass planet, of, you know, 1 AU. And this could be the subject of a 15-minute talk, which I'm not going to give. But anyway, it's only the second, you know, if you're counting Alpha Centauri BB as a real planet, which who knows, then this is the second, you know, such Earth mass planet, you know, around a binary. So I won't go into detail about this, but what I want to say is that you can see over here the residuals from, you know, a non-parallax fit. So you're capturing the parallax, and that's in fact why we know that this is an Earth mass planet and not just some certain mass ratio. So next thing you can do is you can do terrestrial parallax. Okay, I said if you look at from two different observatories, then you see different events. Okay, so I also told you the scaleless phenomena is 1 AU, and you probably know that Earth's not 1 AU. So, you know, if you're looking at two things from the Earth, you're going to see basically the same event. But maybe in some certain cases, you'll see something different. And this is, you know, such a case. So these light curves are separated by, you know, 8 minutes in time. The light curves are separated by 1 minute. The width of this thing is about 8 minutes. Okay, 8 minutes is very short. The reason why it's 8 minutes, whereas typically microlensing events last 30 days, is what we're seeing is the peak of a magnification 2500 event. So the peak goes by very quickly. You could actually measure it. This shows a diagram of how this thing arrived in Canaries and then South Africa and then Chile over the course of a minute. This led to a mass measurement. There's actually a brown dwarf in the thick disk, which is pretty interesting. Here's another one of these. And these two events, I wrote up when the other one was written up by Jennifer Yee. And so we got together and we tried to figure out maybe there should be a lot more of these and we can start to exploit this a lot better if we, you know, tune our observations to it. So we turns out that you can work this out mathematically and write down some equations, which I'm not going to go through, and you can predict how many of these things that you should be seeing over the 10 years of microlensing experiments. And so indeed, we were way off. You know, the number two is way different than the number of expected events. So you're hoping like it's going to be 100, but unfortunately it's 0.1. So what's really weird is not that we discovered so few, but that we discovered so many. So this is not understood, but it's also not the path toward getting a lot of masses. And another issue, which is pretty important in microlensing, you probably have heard about, is the so-called free-floating planets. So this is from the MOA group, and they have a distribution of time scales, and then there's a bump over here. And you're thinking, well, maybe this bump could be produced by some sort of structure in, I don't know, velocity space or something. But no. If you have any sort of continuous distribution at all, you can prove mathematically that that bump cannot be there. So this is the proof, but anyway, yes.
Well, so you have this like fabulous technique to get these masses, and you have two events, and you expected 0.1, and so you really don't know what the source is of the discrepancy. I mean, do you have any clues as to why the expected number is so much smaller? Because you're not that lucky, I don't think.
So. I don't know. It could be publication bias. You know, I mean, so you get lucky in some things and light them up, and then you're hoping for more.
But is it just super high mag events that you guys...
Oh, yeah, so that's what goes into the math of that. You know, so all of that is what we took into account. So anyway, these free-floating planets are quite interesting because there's a huge number of them. Okay, so this is what's shown over here, is that the frequency of these is there's two for every star. Not two for every G star, but two for every garden variety M star. You know, and it's very hard to figure out how there could be so many free-floating planets or what they are, what their mass function is. You know, pretty much nothing about it right now. And this is another reason why we'd like to find masses of individual events. So,
how do we know there are all these free-floating? So what do you assume when you say, okay, we disrupted all these planetary systems, so we know there's this ton of free-floating planets?
So we found two events that can't be explained by this normal thing. But you know, over here, these short time scales, the probability of each one of them is 0.01. So that's worse than what Jen and I came up with. You know, so you got two events with 0.01 probability. So it's possible that you're super unlucky. But it's also possible that these are not really microlensing or something like that. But that's what I would really like to have said, because I looked at the events. I figured I'll just show, you know, it's plausibly, no, microlensing. So we can't guarantee that this is real, but I mean, it's a real problem. It's not something that's explainable away because your galactic model is not good enough or something. You have to have a separate population of low-mass stuff out here to produce this bump, or bad luck.
So in the spirit of sort of cross-cutting, can any of the planet people comment on whether from the other perspectives there's expected to be this free-floating population, either theoretically or what?
I don't think it's particularly scary. I mean, the rate of bound Jupiters around M stars, at least within, I don't know, 5 AU, is not that high. But you could imagine ejecting several from your MGK stars. So, before we interpret it too much, are we confident that these are actually free-floating and not just very wide separation planets?
No, but it's a somewhat similar problem because you have two Jupiter mass planets around Embry-M dwarf. Some of them are actually known to be not that close to their star, and other ones we don't know. So it's a matter of, future investigation.
So is it fair to say that the sum of free-floating planets and very wide separation planets comes to a few per star?
Yes. So
that doesn't offend you.
No. Okay. And how well known are those masses? How well constrained are they? You know, is it a Jupiter mass, or is it between,
Well, if Jupiter mass is the best fit. If it's half a Jupiter mass, then there's more planets, and if it's closer to Neptune, then there's less. So the mass, total mass, is sort of conserved. Okay, so Refsdale in 1966 came up with this idea to put a satellite in solar orbit and measure, microlens parallaxes for all stars, and his diagram. Pretty much completely incomprehensible. So, 30 years later, I wrote a paper independently, without realizing that he had done this. And, happily, it has a lot better diagrams in it. It's an intellectual advance. So, Refsdale wrote me a polite letter informing him that he'd already done this 30 years before. But the basic idea is that if the source and the lens pass by the So the source passes by the lens for different separations and at different times as seen from the Earth relative to the lens, then you're going to get two different microlensing events. You know, the one from Earth here is going to be higher magnifications because it's closer, you know, it has different peak time. And so by looking at these two different times, then you could figure out about how big this is in the Einstein ring. Then you know how big it is physically because you've got radar ranging. And so the only, you know, problem is that you don't know whether geometry is this or this. And so this thing could be, you know, much bigger, and then you'd get a different answer. But anyway, you're on the track. So this is this fourfold degeneracy was a major problem in this area. So when Spitzer went up, or you know, shortly before it was going to go up, it's called CERDEF. I can't remember whether Spitzer got, Mike Warner asked me to try to see if Spitzer could be used as a microlens parallax satellite. So at this time, APJ, you know, took a long time to get back your proofs and stuff. And so and when I got back the proofs, you know, I mean, I couldn't understand these equations anymore. But I figured the author was reliable, and I let it get published. Anyway, this idea was you know, first applied to a fortuitously bright star in the SMC. You know, this was about 5 years ago or 7 years ago. But it was never been applied to BOLE. So I went to a Spitzer meeting in 2007 where they could do warm mission. They invited me specifically to have microlensing then. I explained to them how you could do microlensing, and they told me to get lost because they weren't going to do any target of opportunities. So I kind of gave up on Spitzer. Then through a process that had to do with Kepler breaking down, I was induced to apply to them again. And so this is from the proposal where you see these, how if the lens is in the bulge, the Earth and Spitzer light curves look the same. And then if the lens is in the disk, they look quite different. And so from this, you can figure out the parallax. So I put in a proposal for 832 hours, namely all of the 38 days that you could observe with Spitzer of the bulge because of its sun angle exclusion. And, you know, of course, because of excellent science, the review panel, you know, rated it second quartile. But the director had more sense and gave us 100 hours of time to show, to demonstrate feasibility. So, you know, keep in mind this picture here. And then this is, you know, this is what real data looks like, you know, from Spitzer. So, you know, we actually were able to measure it. So this is one of the first ones that we analyzed. It's done by Jennifer Yee. And we have this fourfold degeneracy, just like was predicted. But actually, using the projected velocity, so because you know the projected size of the Einstein ring, you figure out how big the velocity is projected on the Earth plane. And one of these is pointing in the, right in the direction of the you know, galactic rotation. So you know, this is the one that's singled out. So in this case, this fourfold degeneracy is broken, and it turns out usually it's broken. And so the, you know, we actually did find a planet in the course of this. The planet was discovered over here, but the Spitzer data were already being taken, so the planetary anomaly. So you see that the planet looks just like the same from Spitzer from the Earth. That's just because of the particular geometry. It wouldn't necessarily have to look exactly the same, but displaced. And so this is giving us a handle on, well, this just shows the nightmare that Jennifer and I had to go through to try to do this. So they're very kind and work with us very closely. But still, we end up with a schedule where we would figure out what we want to do on Monday. And then on Thursday, that's over here, on Thursday, the instructions would be uploaded to the satellite and start observing for the next week. So we basically have to predict 10 days in advance. This means nothing to you. But if you're struggling looking at microlensing events for a living and you see something go like this, and then you're wondering whether it's going to go like this or like this, so Rachel is nodding. So everybody else is clueless, but anyway, that's fair. So definitely. So anyway, we did get all these events. Well, this is just illustrating something. And you know, the different geometries were sensitive to rotation of this lens, you know, the orbital motion, and so forth.
Is Spitzer in a particularly favorable orbit for yours? Just anything that's far away, like, we'll do it.
Favorable orbit? Well, it has to be of order the Einstein, projected Einstein radius. So this one was very close. If it's more than a factor of 2 of the Einstein radius, you have a good chance. Otherwise, the chance goes down really fast. But this is a key diagram on the galactic distribution of planets. For each one of 22 events or something that we have here, we don't have both numbers. We don't have the angular Einstein radius and the projected Einstein radius. We just have the projected Einstein radius and we have this fourfold degeneracy. But by a variety of arguments, we can cut down this fourfold degeneracy, and then we can use kinematics, you know, kinematic priors to say where this, what the distance distribution of these lenses is. And so in each case, it's fairly broad. You know, it's not as broad as it used to be, which is basically 0 to 8 kiloparsecs. But here it's broad in the sense like 1 kiloparsec. But if you have 20 of these events, you take the cumulative distribution function, it's, you know, the errors that you're making in these individual measurements don't matter. So you can get the cumulative distribution function really well, and then you can say, where on this do the planets lie? Now, unfortunately, you have to actually have planets and not have planet if you're going to find the galactic distribution of planets. So far, we only have one. And not only that, but this diagram is not actually appropriate to figure out the answer to this, because what I've shown here is the distribution of distances of individual events. But what we want to have is actually the distribution of planet sensitivities, because we've detected a planet, and that has to be measured against the distribution of planet sensitivities. So it's not that hard to calculate that. It just wasn't relevant to this paper. But if we had several planet detections, like, you know, 10, and then a distribution of the underlying events, then we'd be able to figure out, are these planets more frequent in the disk than in the bulge? And that's a pretty important question, because bulge star formation is totally different than disk star formation. So, for example, some people, like Todd Thompson, you know, put forward that maybe you're not going to get Jupiter mass planets in the bulge because the radiation field is so intense that you're not going to, you know, get the core accretion thing going. So that's, you know, we'd like to be able to do that, and, you know, from this one, you know, pilot project, we're not going to do it, but it is now actually feasible to do that. Okay, so just want to mention that this is another avenue, so this is also a great way to do binaries. So nobody cares about binaries because, I don't know, Mark, explain to people why people don't care about binaries. They're losers, you know. But binaries are super important in their own right, and plus there's a lot of binaries that people can't find now, you know, brown dwarf binaries or black hole binaries or whatever. And so, you know, with this sample like this, you can actually measure the mass and distance of these binaries, because binaries are especially useful because they have these caustic crossings, so you can measure both parameters, the parallax and the angular Einstein radius. Okay, so this thing can also be applied to Kepler. So the story behind this, I don't think I really have time to go into details of it, but basically, you know, Keith Horn wrote me a letter when Kepler broke down and said, hey, we can use this for a microlensing. So anyway, the next day I sent him back a draft for AppJar. It was another one of these articles that you think is being filed into the garbage pail, you know, because just like some huge number of ideas that are very great things to do but that people can't recognize are good. But anyway, we eventually wrote this thing up as a, you know, a idea to use for Kepler. And in the meantime, then Kepler, you know, stabilized their two-wheel mode and everything. They were able to actually do observations. So our idea came about long before that. And now it looks like they're actually going to do it. Their field 9 is going to point toward the bulge. So this is what we'd like to do. We'd like to set Kepler down right on top of, you know, where all the bulge microlensing events are taking place. So this is from talk. When did you do this, Rachel? Oh, 2 years ago? Yeah, so, okay. Anyway, time's marching on. But, you know, here's what we can do, or at least what we thought we could do at that time. Then Kepler further adjusted where we could point the field, and we wind up with something more like this. So we're, you know, Kepler has to point up here at the ecliptic, and there's some corner of it that's in the dense microlensing fields. And so, you know, originally we were thinking about this to say, okay, just like Spitzer, we find an event, we tell Spitzer about it, okay, a week later they observe. Kepler can't do that. You tell Kepler about something, first of all, they say like 3 months later they can incorporate you into their stream. And then, even if you can talk them out of that, the thing is looking at the same place for 80 days, so you're not going to be talking to it anyway. So instead we have a different, totally different mode of observation. It's just to put down the, you know, just download 5 square degrees, which, you know, obviously the overwhelming interest in any observation of your microlensing, regardless of where it was, but in this particular case, you got the galactic bulge, and so you could have some other interesting variable things happening there. And so this is really a great way to do the free-floating planets and figure out what they really are. So people are wondering, you know, what are these things? You know, maybe they're CVs or, you know, some weird thing that we haven't found before. So if you have a microlensing event that's, it could be a star, instead of having a free-floating planet over here, you could have a very small Einstein ring if the star was sitting right in the bulge. Okay, this is the lens star. Okay, so instead of being a planet, it's a star. It's still going by really fast. But if that's true, it's parallax. Projected Einstein ring is huge, so its parallax is very small. And then if you look at it from the Earth and from Kepler, you're going to see the same event. But if it's a free-floating planet, it's going to look totally different. So you're going to have, furthermore, if it's a CV or something else, it's going to look exactly the same. I mean, CVs look the same from any angle. But if it's a planet, it's going to show up. And we're going to be able to get a much better estimate of its mass than this crude, I don't know who was asking about this question. But anyway, what are the actual masses of these things? So you still don't know the mass because there's still some degeneracy, but statistically you know. And that, you know, expecting something like 20 of these free-floating planets if the MOA results are correct. Also get some bound planets out of this thing. Okay, so, you know, is microlensing, is the galactic bulge too crowded for Kepler? We don't think so, but, you know, first of all, we're using difference imaging, but, you know, there's going to be many problems, but we're working on the photometry problems right now. Okay, so I want to tell you about some other developments in microlensing. So, like, 10 years ago, the situation was we had these surveys that were, there was one survey in Chile, it was OGLE, another survey in New Zealand, MOA, and they had at this time relatively small cameras, so they were upgrading to higher cameras, and then you could start to think about doing something completely different than what we're doing with survey plus follow-up. You just have a survey, instead of going like this all night, you have it go like this, you know, every 10 minutes, and then you can find Earth mass planets. And so we had a meeting in Heidelberg, I don't know, 2005, and Chen Ho-Han came to that meeting. He said, I'm going to propose to put another camera in Africa. I'm going to try to get $10 million from the Korean government to do that. And anyway, people have a lot of plans. Anyway, we went back and made this proposal, got turned down. So I made a proposal again the next year, and it got turned down. So you realize eventually you're doing something wrong. So he went back the next year, and he said to the Korean government, give me $30 million. I'll build three telescopes, one in each continent. You know, Korea can take over this business. So nationalism wins. So this is the model of it, and you know, this is the actual construction. So actually, these observations, I think, are the first cameras taking its first images tonight or tomorrow night or something like that. And all three cameras should be set up by May. And this is the level of coverage that it's going to have over the course of the year between Chile and Africa and Australia. Okay. So next stop on this road is WFIRST. WFIRST is motivated, well, partly it's motivated by dark energy, but the you know, important science is motivated by the idea that microlensing observations can be done better in space because there's better weather and better seeing. And so if you're in the galactic bulge, you know, you think you're seeing stars. I mean, everybody who's looked at galactic bulge realize, I mean, they look at this thing, they think they're seeing stars, they know, you know, we look at HST image, you're seeing melange of stars. And if you really want to get down to the smaller stars, and so smaller than the caustics of the Earth mass planets, you need to go to space. This has been pointed out by Dave Bennett and his late wife, Sun Ri, more than 10 years ago, that this would be a fabulous way to discover planets. But I'm not going to tell you anything more about that. It's fabulous. It's going to be happening, hopefully, in the future. But really, what I'm going to be telling you about is non-microlensing science in the last couple of minutes here. So, so in order to do this microlensing campaign, you need 40,000 images, you know, covering 3 square degrees. And this can be organized into 6 continuous 72-day campaigns, all the quadrature in the spring and the fall. So 100 images per day with a 0 point of 26.1 in H-band. So the first thing you can do with this is just a fabulous Kuiper Belt object machine. Okay, right now, in this region over here, there's 3 Kuiper Belt objects known with orbit precisions of about 20%. So this, without doing anything, except analyzing the data, I mean, that's not going to be easy, but without doing anything different in observations, WFIRST will discover like 5,000 Kuiper Belt objects with precision orbits of, you know, much less than 1%. Because it's going in such crowded fields, people say don't do this Kuiper Belt survey in crowded fields, it's bad. I'll show you how it's not bad, but anyway, because you are in crowded fields, there's more occultations, and you can actually learn something about the radius. There'll be thousands of occultations. So, you know, this is a question of the referee, for the original referee, this paper, like a large number of referees, is missing a huge fraction of his brain. And he said that, well, you have these crowded fields and you're never going to be able to find anything. So this is an example of such a crowded field, not quite as crowded as the balls, but one where observations are actually done. And by taking difference images, then you can actually discover Kuiper belt objects. So the object itself is invisible in this image, but you know it's easily visible here. So they discovered this Kuiper belt object using effectively blinking, you know. And this same technique was actually used in 1931 to find this same Kuiper belt object, which is Pluto. You find a lot of binaries, so. So you can find binaries of from light centroid motion down to about H of 25. These are very rare, like I said, occultations.
What size does that map to?
Sorry?
What size, like 1 kilometer?
Or? What's the smallest object you find? It's like 20. It's like 7 kilometer diameter. Okay, so so there's a completely different realm, which I think will be of interest to some people in this audience, is W-first precise parallaxes and photometry. So this is showing the astrometric precision of a W-first, single W-first measurement. You see it's like in this range here, fairly bright stars, it's like 60 microarc seconds, and the photometry, you know, is down at millimags for these stars here. Why is this? Because you've got saturated stars and, you know, multiple reads from, and I think I have a diagram showing this. Oops, maybe not. Yeah, so anyway, if you have 60 microarc seconds in one measurement, then if you take 40,000 measurements, you've got, you know, 300 nanoarc second parallaxes. You know, you have 40,000 measurements of, you know, millimag photometry or better. And from that, you can do astroseismology. You can get, you know, you can do a lot of things. I mean, you can get distances to all these stars and ages for many of them if they're near the turnoff of the subgiants. This is the response function, spectral response function of the Kepler data, and this is the W-first data. So W-first looks a lot worse because it's 4 years continuous, and this is both has 72-day things, so that's the envelope here. But both of these are delta functions on the scale that's relevant to almost all stars, except the very, very brightest ones, very few stars. So W-first basically has a delta function response. And then this is, so we took real Kepler data and just added W-first noise and try to see whether we could recover these new maxes, which you can do, except, you know, you start getting below the clump, you can't do it. But anyway, there's a million stars for which you can get astroseismic data in the W-first fields. I should mention this also worked for Euclid. So Euclid feels smaller, but it's being put up by Europeans, so more likely to actually be launched. You know, this is from Mark's paper of the, so there's two of these astroseismic parameters, or two main ones, you know, nu max and delta nu. And so this is his delta nu measurement. This is what it would look like here. You might be wondering, well, you know, you might start to get stuck off in one of these aliases if you didn't really know this is the right one. But you actually do know approximately where the right answer is from just some general scaling relations and from the fact that you have these excellent parallaxes. So we believe that you can get masses and radii for a million stars with W-first. And these are, you know, so Plato's going to get a lot of stars. I get a million also, I think. I can't remember. But anyway, those stars are going to be kind of solar neighborhood, and these stars are, you know, in a dramatically different environment. And it's not just the bulge, 10% of them will be in the disk. Okay, so, you know, this is pretty much my conclusions. I'll just cut off there.
There's a theory plot of a notional 10-year microlens event where the Earth moved back and forth.
Yes.
So the typical time scale is more like a month.
Right.
I wonder what you'd get out of putting a telescope on the moon. So it's wiggling during the microlensing event.
Okay, so that's, so people, a long time ago, people thought of observing them from HST, which is impossible because of the upload requirements. So I thought about doing this for W-first in geosynchronous orbit, where probably it's working a little bit better than the moon. You get these cycles, but actually it's only a few percent of the events that we really get excellent mass measurements there. I think it'd be worth thinking about, you know, but it should be more carefully investigated.
Gina? I was just wondering in these, you know, with this sort of next generation survey where you're actually just staring at the same place again and again and again, with huge cameras, you know, how common is it going to be to actually see the source and lens separate so that you can actually just directly measure the properties of the lens, sort of the way you did in that Gaudi paper?
Okay, so, you know, the main, so it's really, it doesn't have to do with staring, but just waiting for long enough for them to separate. So, I think it'll be up to Carnegie to donate as much as possible of their GMT time to this project, because pretty much some huge fraction of these, you know, will be visible after a few years, because in J-band, full width half maximum, I think, is 11 milliarc seconds, so maybe if they're separated by 20 milliarc seconds, that's like 5 years or something in typical events, then you would be, unless it's very faint, so you will be able to see it. It's just you have to actually go after it with these, you know, very good telescopes. So we're doing it, trying to
take the GMT, like, so I mean, I don't know, I mean, it just seems a lot easier than all that parallax stuff that you're talking about, like, in terms of actually having it happen, because all you have to do is wait, which I think we all can do.
Well, you all can do it, right?
Yes.
Right, and so that's a very good idea. And then even if you have like one-dimensional parallaxes, then you can combine the proper motion, which gives you the Einstein radius with this one-dimensional parallax, and you can get out all the information. So I think that just waiting is, you know, waiting 50 years. Okay, so that's a big wait, but you know, waiting 5 years, you know, and what else is this telescope going to do anyway? It's very limited perspective. So I think that should be turned over to that. And I've published my article about this in Journal of Korea and Astronomical Science, because those people have like 10% of the time, and then they have all the microlensing events. So hopefully those will merge pretty well.
Any questions? There were questions for Andy?
Julio. This short period duration of events, convinced are we that these are microlensing, or what is the?
Well, this is what I told you. I'm an enemy of these events, and
so
a bunch of the. No, wait. So I started out. I just saw this paper. First of all, the paper appeared in Nature, so already has very low probability of being correct. And then, it, you know, there's a lot of garbagey-looking events. I don't know if I want to bring this back, but you had this thing here, and so I looked at the, you know, the events that. So you have this bump here, like this. So these events. You know, there's, you know, there should be 6, and then there's 10, so, you know, that could be just statistical. And, but the events over here are the key ones. There's like one or two of them that are very short time scale. So I individually looked at those events, okay? And one of them is like magnification 30 event. There, you know, unless there's like aliens trying to convince us of free-floating planets or something, there's no way that this thing is not microlensing. And the other one, well, that one I would just bet my house on. The other one, you know, I bet $10,000 on. So it's not, you know, it's not as gold-plated, but it's pretty secure. So that's when I gave up trying to fight this thing and try to figure out what it is. It could be that it is statistical fluctuation. I think Gina suggested that, but it's not bad events.
But that question, it kind of doesn't matter because we're going to have way more in a year, right?
Okay, but that was also true 5 years ago, but we don't have
no, but KMT net's going up, you said, today or tomorrow.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, so we'll have them, not only we'll have them, but the people who are getting them have an interest in publishing them.
So. With KMT net and WFIRST, would we be more sensitive to small mass planets in binary systems rather than around plain old single stars? Because
we think so. You know, so that, you know, I didn't go into detail about that binary system, but it actually has an amazing feature to it. Maybe I can quickly. Oops. It has a really incredible thing in it, which might mean that what you're saying is true. Oops, where is this? Too far back. Okay, so just go through this quickly. So this event has like this tiny little dip here, and this dip means that it passed in between two caustics of a close planet. I don't know, you know, this is just known to all microlensers, but you know, take too long to explain. So we know that, and we know it passed right in between these things and pointing towards the central star. So that's what was noticed here. And then the reason we became involved in this event in heavy follow-up, because it's over, the planet's over. But what we realized was, because of the geometry, it's probably heading into the central star. So we started getting a lot of, you know, amateurs started getting a lot of data over here. And one of them, you know, sent us an email. He's just poking through the clouds, you know. And then, you know, he has a wait of an hour. And then he says, hey, I've waited an hour, I got a hole in the cloud, and it's a magnitude brighter. So then we started getting all this data over here. So, and then it was analyzed. It's actually not that easy to analyze this thing. But one of the things that was done was, so, okay, so this huge double peak here is just clear binary, okay? You don't have to do any modeling to realize that this is due to a binary. And then what we did was we modeled this binary taking out this planet, okay? And the delta chi-square from this binary was larger than the delta chi-square for the direct detection of the planet. So the reason is that this tiny little planet distorted the caustic due to the binary enough to be able to clearly notice it. So we think that maybe, you know, if you looked at binaries where there was no planet, you could infer the planet, because, you know, the chance that it's going to pass this planet is like, you know, 1 in 500 or something like that. So, you know, going over the binary, that's like 1 in 10. So it's possible that we could detect a lot more planets around binaries through this other channel. But people haven't really studied whether it's due to some peculiarity of the geometry that we luckily got this, or it's you know, something generic.
Bump A is not from the planet, it's just from the binary.
Oh yeah, so that's, this is, right, sorry. Yeah, so this is taking place, you know, wait, so this is 6,000 days and this is 6,400. So this is how we know it's a wide binary, not a close binary. This is another whole issue, but wide and close binaries are degenerate in these structures here, and if we took out this thing here, we couldn't tell the difference between the two of them. But because it went by the other star, then, you know, it caused this tiny little bump, and that's how we know it. But that's not that relevant to the planet issue, other than it tells us it's going around one star and not circumbinary planet.
All right, well, if there are any more questions, let's thank Andy.